special committee on energy by order of 10:02. Present today are Vice Chair Spahnholz, Representative Klayman, Representative Westlake, Representative Johnston, and Representative Brasher, and myself, Chair Wool. Today we'll be doing HB 81 for the second time, eligibility for Alaska energy efficient loans. Following HB 81, we'll have a presentation by AEA, Alaska Energy Authority. To begin with, I'd like to bring the bill sponsor back up. If you could come forward and tell us who you are and what you're doing.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jonathan Christ-Tompkins, representative for District 35, rural Southeast Alaska, and sponsor for House Bill 81.
And I believe we have an amendment to move.
I move Amendment A4.
And I'll object for the purposes of discussion. Any further discussion on the amendment? And maybe our bill presenter can present his amendment as well.
I have an A.1, but I don't have a...
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I may maybe lean on Barrett Wilbur, who is the brains behind this amendment.
Good morning. My name is Barrett Wilbur, staff to Rep. Christ-Tompkins, through the chair. This amendment came after discussions with the Alaska Housing, with Stacey Schubert at the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and Katie Conway at AEA. And they brought up the point that 501c12s, the nonprofit designation that electric co-ops currently fall under. The bill currently applies to electric co-ops. And they felt that because electric co-ops, their job is to produce and generate power, AHFC doesn't feel like it has the expertise in its vetting process for loans to give energy efficiency loans to power generators, at least for the purpose of power generation and distribution. I have a feeling a conceptual amendment might be offered in a few seconds to allow electric co-ops to get efficiency loans to do building envelope efficiencies only, but nothing that has to do with kind of distribution back to the power grid. So that's the nature of this amendment.
Thank you. Any questions? Comments? Is that Representative Westlake?
Yeah, and so what I'm hearing over here, this is particular to each individual building. It isn't a matter of anything other than efficiencies to that building. Am I hearing this correctly?
Representative Westlake, through the chair, yes, that's correct in my estimation. Although Stacey Schubert from AHFC and Katie Conway from AEA are in the room, and they can speak to that in more detail if necessary.
I'd like to recognize that Representative Johnson is here at the table now. Would either aforementioned like to speak to the amendment? No.
Pardon me?
You have a follow-up?
If it's speaking to the amendment, I'd like to, for as we look at the amendment out here offered to the House, lines 10, 11, and 12 on the packet here, in there is just to be succinct, since we're talking about buildings out here, is I'd like to offer in a conceptual amendment to this amendment, if we will. I'm sorry, I can wait. Did you need? Oh, okay. Thank you. Okay. To allow for these entities to be eligible for the purposes of building efficiencies, not generation efficiencies. We want to be very succinct in that this is for the House itself that's going forward. Thank you.
So Representative Westlake, you'd like to add a conceptual amendment to Amendment A4 stating that these funds would be available for energy efficiency, i.e. building envelope, et cetera, but not for power generation.
And to the chair, yes, and Nick, perhaps AEA, if we can get them up here to address this, it would work.
Sure.
Thank you, Chair.
All right. Would you state your names and affiliation? That'd be great.
Katie Lister, Chief Economist, Alaska Energy Authority.
Katie Conway, Government Relations Manager, Alaska Energy Authority. And if I may also, Chair Wu.
Yes.
Katie Lister manages the Power Project Loan Fund at Alaska Energy Authority.
Okay. In regards to...
Yes, I'd like you to speak to this amendment that I'm offering as a conceptual amendment here for all of us to understand this whole issue.
Through the chair, I think so. AEA supports this conceptual amendment. We have the Power Project Fund Loan Program, which offers loans for generation projects and for generation, distribution, and transmission of energy systems, and including supply side efficiency measures. And so that would be new diesel gen sets, reducing line loss through various technical means, potentially ampere prepaid meters in people's homes. We believe that it's important to maintain lending to power generators, particularly in rural Alaska, within AEA, because we have staff with the technical capacity to be able to assess and evaluate the appropriateness of the projects, and not just the appropriateness, but often the whether or not they're legal. There are a lot of EPA regulations on diesel as prime power, and those change a lot, and Alaska has sort of waivers, special waivers and exemptions and things like that. So tracking that and making sure that the applicants from rural powerhouses are getting loans on equipment that is actually legal to install is pretty critically important and something that we frequently see.
And if I may, do you offer loans towards this energy efficiency building envelope type stuff, or simply it's power generation, distribution, and
transmission? Yep.
Thank you. So this augmenting this AHFC loan for efficiency would be would sort of dovetail nicely with your loan program, is that correct?
Or to the chair, yeah, I believe that it could.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Katie and Katie. As far as the amendment to the amendment, conceptually speaking, I'm not sure how that gets amended right now, if we can do it simply verbally, if we have to take a break and draft something up. But are there any other discussion points to the amendment A4 at this point? Or to the conceptual amendment that Representative Westlake has proposed?
Chair.
Vice Chair Spahn.
I would propose that we take an Addies and get some language written up before we make an official vote on it. Or alternatively, we could hold it over to the next committee meeting, which is not really my desire, but I just want to make sure. I prefer not to vote on conceptual amendments until I'm clear what the specifics are.
Sure.
I don't want to make sure we avoid unintended consequences.
That's fine. And we also have another amendment for this bill, but I'll take a brief at ease right now to deal with the conceptual amendment on Amendment A4. Call the meeting back to order. After discussion of the conceptual amendment to Amendment A4, the conceptual amendment is stating that these loans may be used by a entity organized with the primary purposes of owning, operating, managing, or controlling a plant or system for furnishing electric service by generation, transmission, or distribution if it is used for energy efficiency, building envelope, or consumption efficiency. The loan can be used for that, but not for any kind of power distribution, transmission, or generation. Is everyone okay with that?
Might I restate, just to be sure that I'm clear,
yes.
Chair?
Yes.
So we're stating that that this amendment does not include an entity organized for the purpose of owning, operating, managing, or controlling a plant or system for furnishing electric service by generation, transmission, or disservice, except for the purposes of energy efficiency of the building.
Or buildings that they may own.
Yes. Roughly. Okay.
Representative Westlake.
With the chair's indulgence, if the representative, the sponsoring representative, would like to address this, please.
Thank you, Representative Westlake, through the chair. The conceptual amendment makes sense to me. I think it's consistent with the intent of improving energy efficiency. Thumbs up.
I remove my objection to Amendment A4 with conceptual amendment. Are there any objections? Okay. With that amendment, A4 will be adopted. And I believe we have another amendment.
Yes, sir. The chair, I move amendment number two.
Just the conceptual amendment. And that's the whole thing?
We accept, we adopt Amendment A4 with conceptual amendment as aforementioned.
Okay.
Thank you. And Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Chair. I move Amendment number two.
And I object for purposes of discussion.
Amendment number two. Would add language to limit the funds available to be lent through this program to tax-exempt entities, federally recognized tribes, and regional housing authorities to the original amendment was 10%, and I believe we kind of negotiated out 30%, but either way, of the binding authority for the corporation for the program, the Senate Bill 220 in 2010 established the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Fund. This legislation also included bonding authority for the program up to $250 million. Thus, whatever percentage we use in my amendment, it's 10%, equals $25 million for the purpose of this bill. This limit would preserve the loan funds available for use by municipal governments, regional education, attendance areas, and the University of Alaska is originally intended by the establishing legislation passed in 2010, while still approving for an ongoing lending authority for the new entities that would qualify under the HB 81. So, quoting the sponsor statement, especially given our new and more austere fiscal climate in which legislative grants are going to be rare to non-existent, many nonprofits are interested in becoming more self-sufficient and accessing loans from the revolving loan fund to invest the energy efficiency. So, that's the purpose.
Okay. Any other discussion?
I have some questions.
Representative Klein?
I'm kind of not clear about the intent of the amendment because I thought the testimony we heard is here's this fund and no one's borrowing any money from it, or they've had one loan come out of it in 4 years. And this amendment appears to basically say we're only going to loan some of the money out when hardly anybody's applying for it in the first place. Why would we legislatively restrict a quasi-government authority that we actually want them out loaning money? Why would we start trying to tell them how to loan the money when right now we're trying to get the money to be get used?
Mm-hmm. Chair?
Yep, Representative Rauscher.
The purpose of the bill is to generate a source for these new loans, which we are imagining of writing a bill because we think they'll be taken advantage of, then I think we should allow some remaining funds for the original intent of the money to begin with, because they weren't used doesn't mean they won't be used, in my opinion. And the original intent was of the money was for certain use, and now if you open it up, it could just drain and deplete that. So the original intent is not to have any money available for it.
Representative Sponholz, you have a question?
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that the original legislation still allows for a priority for the originally intended beneficiaries of this, and that this is simply widening the net. It's not putting nonprofits in the position of essentially trumping public agencies for the benefit of these services. And if what we're trying to do is to ensure that we're actually reducing energy costs across the state of Alaska and being more efficient with our resources, particularly because many of these nonprofits are funded by state government, I would argue that this amendment is a solution in search of a problem.
And to that, we have Stacy Schubert on the line from AHFC, who maybe has some input to this question. Stacy, are you there?
Hello, Mr. Chairman. Yes, this is Stacy Schubert.
Have you heard the discussion just prior here about an amendment as far as retaining a portion of the available funds that if 10 or 20 or 30% is used for nonprofits and tribal entities, that the remainder would stay reserved for public buildings, which was the original intent of the loan of the funds? Can you talk to that issue?
Mr. Chairman, yes. This is Stacy Schubert, the Director of Public Relations for Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. We are neutral on the amendment. It is something that we could implement, but we have no preference one way or another.
Seeing as the history of the program has only had two applicants and one loan, do you foresee any kind of increase in applications by either the tribal entities and nonprofits that this HB 81 addresses, or do you see an increase in applicants from public entities in the environment of there being less available grants and so-called free money? Do you think either of those things will lead to a sort of major increase in loan applications to this fund?
Mr. Chairman, for the record again, this is Stacy Schubert, and the original legislation gives us the ability to bond up to $250 million. Should there be more interest in the program, we certainly could come back to the legislature and have that conversation with you at a future point.
Thank you. Representative Clement.
I'm not sure whether this is best addressed to Ms. Schubert or to Representative Rauscher, but have you heard any municipalities or local government entities complaining about lack of ability to apply for the fund anything like that that's come up? I'm not sure. Ms. Schubert, have you had anyone?
Through the chair.
Through the chair. Oh, looks like Representative Rauscher can answer. Go ahead, Representative Rauscher.
My answer would be no.
And follow up through the chair. Representative Rauscher, has any municipality contacted you and said, we're concerned that if this happens, that suddenly the money won't be available for us when we apply?
Through the chair, for the original purpose, yes. It's a possibility.
But has a municipality contacted you with that concern?
Through the chair, no.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, if I may just speak, I've spent a lot of time in municipal government as mayor for the last 6 years. I just finished my term in October, and I have to say I didn't know about this as a mayor. So, I mean, I think that's probably a universal, I don't know if that's universal, but I think it's probably one of those things that's kind of an unknown possibility and as far as use. And then secondly, I can't speak for all municipal government, but I would say that, if I was speaking from a municipal perspective, I might say that I would want to chance at the pot of money, I guess. So it's only a statement. It's not a question, and I can't even say I'm speaking in any way from municipal government. I'm just saying from my perspective. But I think mostly one of the reasons it's this pot of money that's out there is because no one really knows about it.
Thank you. I can't answer to who knows about it or who doesn't know about it. I also, to me, $250 million of bonding ability seems like a lot of money, and it's underutilized. And the representative from AHFC said if for some reason that amount should get all used, they could approach for more bonding ability. I do think that if a lot of loans went out to all three of the aforementioned entities, that would be a good thing, because energy efficiency and less fuel consumption is something that we're after, whether it's by public buildings, nonprofits, tribal entities. I think across the board that would be a good thing, and access to these loans would be a good thing too. I don't know if it should be limited to which entity gets how much. Certainly if the whole fund is exhausted, that would be a problem, and maybe not such a bad problem. So I don't know if anyone else has any thoughts on the issue, but
I actually appreciate your objection, everyone. I actually oppose the amendment. I think that they tend to concur with Representative Sponholz that this is a solution in search of a problem, I think is the phrase. And the original intent, I believe, of this legislation was not to pick who got the energy loans, but to basically say, we have energy efficiency issues, let's get some funds out there and get people that will actually use them. And the history is no one's using them, whether that's because they didn't advertise well or because municipalities were getting grants without having to pay interest on them or whatever was the cause. The municipalities went out there and didn't apply for this, and so this is an effort to say Alaskans will be served by increasing energy efficiency, and if it turns out these groups want to apply for it and we increase efficiency, and meanwhile the municipalities keep thinking, well, I don't really feel like it, we actually are doing the community a disservice by limiting access to the funds, and the municipalities, maybe they'll learn more about it that they didn't know when the bill first passed, and they'll start applying as well, because I think the idea is we'd like to see AHFC coming back and say, look, we had so much popularity, we loaned $250 million and it's saving Alaskans money, and we want to keep doing it. But until we hit 250, I'm loath to want to turn the spigot off. Not that the spigot is open, because no one's even asking for the loans to speak of. So I will
maintain it.
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't object, but I would support the objection. Okay. And don't support the
amendment. And Representative Rauscher, do you wish to continue to move the amendment? I'm sorry. Representative Johnson?
When you made the amendment, you said 10%, and then you said you negotiated up to 30%.
Through the chair.
Representative Rauscher.
I was talking earlier with with Representative Tompkins. We all sat around. We had talked that maybe a bigger amount would be more in line. And I don't think the intent is not to make loans for the of this amendment, not to make loans for energy efficiency. It's just to make sure that there is money for the original intent of the fund to begin with, and that's all it is. It's not to limit anybody's ability to make any kind of efficiency loans, or not to reap what would be actually good for people, to make these loans. It's just to ensure that the original intent was there for its purpose.
Representative Johnston.
I guess I'd like to speak in favor of the amendment, because I do feel that we have a changing environment, and I do feel that actually a lot of your public buildings are going to require larger efforts, which will take more money than maybe some of your smaller nonprofits. And while it's been stated that it's a solution in search of a problem, the reverse could be true, because 30% is actually a rather large number. And I think it's just a nice compromise to to make sure that the intent of the original language is maintained.
Representative Rusher.
Just one more comment to the chair. It can always renegotiate.
Point taken. We could also renegotiate at the other end too if all the money gets depleted. So I mean, I guess Representative Johnson.
I would like to put myself on the record speaking in favor of the amendment because, and I got started with this discussion, that we should remember that these are public buildings in the public trust. They've been paid for with public monies, and this is set up so public monies will be borrowed and public monies will be paid back. And because of that, I think that we're in, you know, it's fulfilling the original purpose. It's fulfilling the public trust. And I don't think there's a whole lot more to say to that because what we're talking about is taking something that was set up for the public trust and changing it into enhancing buildings that are in the private nonprofit sector.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I don't believe the amendment addresses privately owned buildings. Is that correct? It's only tribal entities and nonprofits, but not privately owned. Representative Tompkins, can you mention that?
Mr. Chair, addressing the comment from Ms. Johnson in your question, you are correct, although I think also Ms. Johnson is correct because I think she said private nonprofits, so I think the issue may be inadvertently conflated. Technically, nonprofits are private organizations. Of course, nonprofits are not what we normally think of as private corporations or private individuals. And private nonprofits, in order to become a nonprofit, have to satisfy a public benefit and a public good, which is why they exist.
Okay.
Hello?
Representative Johnson.
A nonprofit organization is a private entity.
Thank you. I'm going to call a brief of these at this point. Order. We're discussing Amendment A2, to which there is an objection. And I believe that objection is maintained. So Representative Rauscher, I'll call on you.
Thank you. I'd like to move a friendly amendment to change line 10 to 30%.
Let the record reflect that line 10 of Amendment A2 will remove the number 10% and increase it to 30%.
For purposes of, well, not really discussion, I oppose the amendment, as I stated before. I don't oppose the amendment to 30% from 10%, but my objection to the amendment still remains.
Okay. So the objection to Amendment A2 still remains. It has been amended on line 10 to reflect the number 30%, but we will have a roll call vote on the amendment. Is the secretary can call roll call?
Representative Rauscher?
On the amendment, yes.
Representative Westlake? Representative Johnson?
Pass.
Representative Johnston?
Yes.
Representative Klayman?
No.
Representative Sponholz?
No.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Chair Wolf?
No.
Three yeas, three nays.
Look at this. Somebody happens to them.
With a 3-3 vote on the amendment fails. Now the question before the committee is, Is there a consensus in passing this bill out of this committee? HB 81.
As amended.
Any discussion?
As amended.
Just a brief discussion.
Representative Klayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been some discussion about what is the original intent of this bill, and I think the original intent of this bill remains try to get energy efficient loans into the community, and it was never intended at its onset to be specific to any particular group. I think the original thought was that if you make it available to municipalities, they all come quickly forward and use up all the loan funds, but that hasn't happened. So I think that this proposal from Representative Christ Tompkins, House Bill 81 as amended, is 100% consistent with the original goal and intent of the original legislation, which is to get funds available for energy efficiencies throughout Alaska. So I would be pleased to support passage of this bill.
Representative Johnson.
I guess I would have to have a different view on that, and so I will be not in favor of passing this out of committee, but because I do believe, like I said, it was for the public trust, it was in the public trust, it was public funds. I think it was a large amount of money administered by a public entity, and so I believe the intent of this bill was to further allow public buildings to be able to, and municipalities and so on, to upgrade their facilities. So it would save public money.
Representative Rusher.
To the chair, I would just make a statement that I agree with the representative from Palmer on her thoughts on public money and the where it's headed now.
Any other comments? I would say that this is a HFC, which is a state entity that loans money to private individuals to buy homes. And this is also money that's bonded for public buildings. And this bill opens it up to other entities, seeing as the fund was barely used, although maybe a lot of municipalities did not know about it. For today's discussion, I will hold this bill over one more meeting, and we will come back to this one. Thank you. And with that, we'd like to get up the representatives from AEA to put on their presentation. Brief it is. At this point, a presentation from the Alaska Energy Authority, and we have two women, both named Katie, that are presenting. So if you switch back and forth, you might want to say your last name too. But proceed. If you could introduce yourself. And
thank you, Chair Will and members of the committee. This is Katie Conway and Katie Lister. Thank you for having us here today. We're very excited to bring you the Alaska Affordable Energy Strategy. This is a pretty big project we're going to tell you about, and one that typically generates a lot of discussion. So to stay focused on just this initiative, we have not included slides in our presentation related to any other AEA project or program, and we'd be more than happy to come back some other time and tell you about all of the good work we do at AEA, but today we're really hoping we can talk only about the Affordable Energy Strategy. We've divided the presentation into two halves. The first is background, and in the second we'll go to the recommendations. And we've built in a pause, a natural pause, on slide 16, where we can take questions without interrupting the flow of the presentation. After that, once we get into the recommendations, we found through previous presentations on this topic that it seems to benefit the audience most if we can get through the recommendations before taking questions again. They're interrelated. I'll be starting with some background, and then Katie will take over a few slides before the pause. And finally, I just want to take a moment to introduce Neil McMahon, who I believe is on the line. He was the project manager for the Alaska Affordable Energy Strategy. He's AEA's energy planning manager. And so if we get technical questions, we will probably be deferring to him. film is First Picture, which is a clear night sky of Alaska. You'll notice that Southeast is not on the picture. I could not find a clear night sky of the entire state without clouds covering Southeast. So in this picture, you can see through that night sky that the lights are on. And note, if you will, all the really small dots of light scattered throughout the state and their contrast to the larger concentrations of light along the rail belt. It's pretty incredible that despite the size of these small communities and their remote locations, and the fact that they're on isolated grids not connected to one another, the lights are on. What this picture doesn't show you is what it takes to keep those lights on. It's pretty easy to take for granted the ease at which we simply flip a switch and light our homes and workplaces, but in reality, the energy systems generating and distributing that power are complicated, require a lot of work to sustain, and unlike systems in the rail belt, because they're not connected to a grid, they lack backup. Power, and heat as well, that's just as important, for our homes, businesses, and community facilities is the backbone on which our communities rely. Energy we can each afford to pay is not a luxury, it's a fundamental need none of us can do without. In much of Alaska, energy infrastructure is made up of the pictures you see here. Bulk fuel, tank farms, which are critical for heat as well as power, power generation facilities, and electrical distribution. These are the things that keep lights on and buildings warm. We can't overestimate the importance of maintaining this critical infrastructure and the need for continuous improvement and replacement as old things reach the end of their expected useful lives. Just to give you a sense of the capital cost associated with this infrastructure, from AEA's Rural Power System Upgrade Program, which serves communities of up to 2,000 people, we estimate that the yearly capital cost to merely replace existing electricity generation and bulk fuel storage as they reach the end of their useful lives is more than $30 million. That doesn't include the operational costs for personnel, regular O&M, or the diesel stored and burned. In about the last 15 years, more than $1 billion, federal and state dollars, has been invested in energy projects in non-rail belt Alaska. Approximately three-quarters of that was federal. Today, we find ourselves in a very different situation. While the need to continually invest remains relatively constant, the availability of public funding to help meet that need is decreasing. And so communities and utilities have to find other ways to deliver safe, reliable, stable, and affordable energy services. This transition will be difficult for some. What state government can do to help, even with reduced state budgets, is to ensure a framework is in place to maximize federal dollars, encourage private sector investment, prepare communities and utilities for debt financing solutions rather than relying exclusively on public funding to implement projects, ensure proper project selection given the unique circumstances of any individual community, and provide technical assistance and consumer protection. The Alaska Affordable Energy Strategy offers such solutions. Think of the Affordable Energy Strategy as a framework for changing the way we currently provide critical energy programs and services, a way that has been heavily dependent on generous state and federal grants to accommodate the necessary transitions of Alaska's new budgetary reality. When making energy decisions, we need to think in terms of the whole community to determine which energy cost solutions make the most sense. The Affordable Energy Strategy Framework includes recommendations for doing just that. It is a strategic plan to improve the methods by which the state works with non-rail belt communities and utilities to identify, evaluate, develop, and maintain cost-effective energy solutions. The Affordable Energy Strategy originated as a part of the gas line legislation in 2014. The legislature asked AEA to develop a plan, quote, for developing infrastructure to deliver more affordable energy to areas of the state that are not expected to have direct access to a North Slope natural gas pipeline. We worked with AGDC to determine who would have direct benefit, which is consumers in the rail belt. The Affordable Energy Strategy, therefore, applies to everywhere else, and that includes Southeast. We were also asked to consider existing state energy policy such as the 15% by 2020 energy efficiency and 50% by 2025 renewable energy goals established in 2010. Before we continue, a few key points worth remembering through the rest of the presentation. First, we want to emphasize that only non-railbelt regions make up the study area. Because of that, research, analysis, and stakeholder engagement did not consider at all the railbelt. This project was a data and research-based project conducted over 2 years, so today's presentation is a very high-level summary of a lot of very dense and detailed information coming out of that effort. Some people may expect to see a list of capital projects. We haven't done that. Given the uncertainty with funding a set list of projects, AEA focused on improving the decision-making process and expanding the availability of financing tools for energy projects. The forthcoming presentations will be presented in a linear way for ease of explanation, but in reality, it's better to think of them as a web in which they are all heavily interconnected. Though the recommendations only target non-railbelt Alaska, the benefits of implementing some or all of them could be statewide. Every dollar we stretch allows us to do more with less, which is good for everyone no matter where you live. And it's especially relevant today in light of the state's fiscal situation. There's a wildly variable set of circumstances influencing energy costs in the study area, which range from small, isolated villages 100% reliant on diesel for power and heat to larger, interconnected cities with nearly 100% renewable electricity generation. The median community size within the study area is 300 people. 76% of communities in the study area are not connected by road or marine highway. The median electric rate in the study area before PCE is 62 cents a kilowatt hour, and the median cost of heating oil is $4.55 a gallon. Keep in mind, a gallon equivalent of natural gas in South Central costs less than a dollar a gallon.
One question, please. This $4.55 price, what year was that? Was that 2014?
That was 2016.
2016, so just recently?
Yes, very recent.
Thank you.
Whether state dollars or federal, local utility or utility customer, the affordable energy strategy aims to ensure all those dollars are spent to maximize their value. Implementing the recommendations you'll hear today will do several things. It will improve project selection, ensuring the most cost-effective projects are those done first. It will help to diversify financing options, removing at least some of the difficulty currently prohibiting some communities from developing projects. And through requirements and incentives that encourage best financial, managerial, and technical practices, the affordable energy strategy could lead to stronger accountability and maximize the useful life of assets. Over the course of the last 2 years, AEA considered more than 150 reports and studies from within and outside Alaska, and the analysis of more than 3,000 potential energy infrastructure projects in Alaska, including projects from the Renewable Energy Fund, the Rural Power System Upgrade Program, the Home Energy Rebate Program, residential weatherization, bulk fuel tank farms, and other publicly available feasibility reports. This project also incorporated the work of recently concluded regional energy plans and the community-vetted priorities developed through that very extensive stakeholder engagement process. Finally, this project commissioned specific studies to fill in gaps in knowledge related to end-use efficiency, liquefied natural gas, fuel delivery and storage, utility management structures, and barriers to private investment in rural Alaska. We looked at the entire energy system within the study area and not just at programs and services offered by AEA. All of the information is built into a model called the Alaska Affordable Energy Model to compare different energy infrastructure options and which can be used to help communities or policymakers better identify the most cost-effective projects to consider. For the purpose of this study and the following recommendations, affordable is interchangeable with cost-effective, meaning essentially the lowest cost option given the unique circumstances of a specific place at a specific moment in time. AEA found that it would be difficult to dramatically lower costs, but there are plenty of opportunities for improving cost effectiveness. Most noteworthy is energy efficiency. For both residential and non-residential buildings and facilities, this is the most common, has the highest expected savings, and is consistently the most cost-effective opportunity across the study area. Many of the strongest opportunities for more affordable energy, such as non-residential efficiency, are difficult to capture within the current system of energy programs and services. AEA found, through this project, that given the variability of cost-influencing conditions in communities, the circumstantial nature of affordability, there are no one-size-fits-all solutions. And Katie will take it from here.
Thank you, Katie. Alaska Energy Authority. The Affordable Energy Strategy proposes an evidence-based management framework to guide decision-making that is based on a foundation of collaboration and research. The recommendations are organized into four categories or pillars. The first is identification of cost-effective projects, followed by financing those cost-effective projects, creating systems of accountability and sustainability, and then the fourth is funding state energy programs. These pillars all support a goal of delivering safe, stable, reliable, and affordable energy. The recommendations are interconnected. We've put them into these pillars to make them a little bit easier to talk about, but many of the recommendations influence multiple categories. Building off of the successes of Alaska's many past and current energy programs and recognizing that the levers available to state government to influence local decision-making and action are limited, each of the solutions proposed by the Affordable Energy Strategy employ at least one of the following kind of mechanisms. One is direct financing, either through grants, loans, or incentives. The second is technical assistance, such as the collection and sharing of data, information, analysis, evaluation, and consultation. And then the third is requirements, such as mandates, regulations, and standards. In order to recommend ways to improve the status quo, we examine the entire energy system to identify pain points where barriers and risks were leading to higher cost energy. Historic state and federal funding for energy infrastructure has in some communities created an expectation of grants, which can lead to delayed implementation of beneficial projects and has also led to, in some cases, an underdevelopment of the administrative and financial structures that are needed to be able to access debt financing. Helping energy project developers like utilities and communities meet standards necessary for loan financing will reduce the need for state capital expenditure in the future. The way that the state and federal funding has been granted has also, in some cases, led to the development of projects based on funding availability rather than the actual need of the community. The expected performance and/or economic life of energy projects is also sometimes not always realized. Maintenance and operations of energy systems requires a certain level of technical, business, and financial capacity and expertise that isn't always available at the local level. What we've put together is a menu of options to be considered for implementation. There are synergies between many of the recommendations, but benefits can also be found in each of them individually. You may like some of the recommendations more than others. We think that there's something in here that will resonate with everyone. Please keep in mind that not all of the recommendations are applicable in every single community, but taken as a whole, the Affordable Energy Strategy offers meaningful, realistic, and achievable solutions for the entire study area. Before we launch into the recommendations, now is the time that we could have anticipated we might have a pause and answer any questions about the slides so far.
Representative Kleinman.
You mentioned the cost for heating oil at average of $4.55 in rural communities, and I think the kilowatt hour average was 80 cents?
62.
How does that compare with heating oil in urban Alaska and kilowatt hour prices in urban Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Kleinman, I don't have the cost per kilowatt hour of all of the urban communities, and there is a lot of variability. For example, Fairbanks pays a much higher electric rate than Juneau or even Anchorage, and areas of the state such as Anchorage and parts of the Valley and the Kenai that have access to natural gas for heating have some of the lowest heating costs in the state.
Okay.
I can tell you that the equivalent, the sort of the energy equivalent in Anchorage is less, would be less than a dollar a gallon for heating oil. And Fairbanks is about 26 cents per kilowatt hour at this point, depending on what your am I wrong?
For like Golden Valley?
For Golden Valley.
They're around 17 right now.
All in? Kind of.
I'm hopefully I'm not misspeaking, but on your, I mean, they have different rates depending on what power, where it's coming from.
Right.
But on your bill, your kilowatt hour, and the one that they have to announce rate increases and such, I think it's in the 17 cents. And many on the rail belt are between maybe 16 and within a few pennies of that.
Okay, well, I have
rail belt generation. There is some expensive generation, again, depending on where they're getting their exact power from on a particular day.
Right.
But.
And through the chair, I can say that for the weighted average cost for Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau is about 16 cents.
All right. Thank you.
And that's population weighted.
All right. Any questions? I guess I have one. You mentioned that this wasn't, you didn't look at particular capital projects, you were just going over the process mostly in this report, but you mentioned 3,000 projects were looked at. Over what, how does that fit in?
So, through the chair, this is Katie Lister. This is the Alaska Energy, the model that was developed to evaluate potential projects in each community relies on the best available data, and that is data that is available from studies that have been done over the years by the state, the Army Corps of Engineers, federal government, building sort of analysis that has been done through different efficiency programs, all of that kind of brought together along with some other socioeconomic and population data to evaluate at a reconnaissance, at sort of a reconnaissance level for each community, what their opportunities are for lowering the cost of power. And that's the output of that is okay. those 3,000 projects.
Okay. Thank you.
Through the chair, if I can ask what time the committee ends today, how much time we have left?
I believe noon.
Okay.
You can proceed.
So, getting started. Current state energy goals include energy efficiency and renewable targets, in-state gas, use of Power Project Fund loan as a primary financing tool, and leadership in renewable and alternative energy. AEA recommends that the state energy policy be amended to include a goal that formalizes the commitment the state already works toward every day of delivering critical energy programs and services to ensure safety, stability, reliability, and affordability in communities by 2030. The recommendations that follow will outline how to achieve this goal despite the limited availability of state funding. So moving into the first pillar, identification of cost-effective projects, and just a note that that box contains energy data. That's what the picture is of. The three recommendations under this pillar support access to better community-level data that is necessary to make well-informed decisions about energy projects and programs. Good decision-making is based on good data. We already have a lot of data in order that we already have access to a lot of data to understand community goals, consumer needs, utility needs, and environmental needs. And these data are captured from individual programs, reporting requirements, but there are still gaps that could be filled to be able to make better decisions at the local level. Existing state collaboration around data collection and sharing includes projects such as the Alaska Energy Data Gateway, the Alaska Retrofit Information System, which houses building-level energy use data, data collection from the Power Cost Equalization Program and Renewable Energy Fund reporting requirements, and the Alaska Affordable Energy Model, which we've mentioned a couple times now. That's the online reconnaissance level analysis tool that was developed for this project. And just a note that it is on our website, so if any of you have a particular interest in you know, geeking out with energy data, it's there, and you can go and do that. We'll be sure and send out a link. Building off of these existing efforts, we recommend formalizing responsibility to collect and have publicly accessible community-level energy data, as well as data for all state energy programs, and to regularly update the Alaska Affordable Energy Model in order to provide guidance regarding the cost-effectiveness of energy infrastructure opportunities. The Affordable Energy Strategy recommends codifying and clarifying the work already done by AEA and other state agencies to help ensure the most efficient and cost-effective energy systems are being identified and built. For communities seeking assistance to reduce energy costs, the state will work with them to identify, plan, and assist in financing energy projects and programs. Targeting PCE communities first would provide significant savings in these high-cost areas, both to the communities and also savings to the PCE program. We'll provide assistance with technical scoping for all phases of project development. This recommendation builds on the work that the state already performs and aims to clarify responsibility that was outlined in 2010's House Bill 306 to, quote, work to identify and assist with development of the most cost-effective long-term sources of energy for each community statewide. Recommendation A3 is to establish building energy codes for new residential and non-residential construction and major renovation. Building to an efficient standard is cost-effective. It saves energy throughout the life of the building and is less expensive than retrofitting later. It just makes sense that new buildings should be built with lower operational costs in mind, so that they are not a financial burden to their owners and occupants for decades to come. This recommendation builds on extensive research that has been done by the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and will provide savings to the PCE program, the Alaska Housing Heating Assistance Program, should it be refunded, as well as potential benefits to public health, safety, and the environment. The second pillar is financing cost-effective projects. And this pillar includes five recommendations that aim to improve access to and expand the types of financing tools available to communities to better leverage non-state dollars and to connect potential investors or lenders with bankable projects. Additionally, because new financing tools don't work by themselves, we need to make sure that we have both projects and entities that are bankable and a skilled workforce to construct and maintain those projects. The first recommendation is to allow bulk fuel loan participants to purchase non-diesel fuels. The bulk fuel loan program offers communities an easy-to-use, low-cost financing tool to purchase large quantities of petroleum fuels, thereby reducing the per-unit cost and reducing the risk of non-payment to distributors. As biomass projects increase in numbers throughout the state, the same mechanism to purchase non-petroleum fuels, such as cordwood or pellets, would be a benefit in many communities.
So right now, bulk fuel is only allowed to purchase diesel fuel. Is that correct?
Petroleum fuel.
The funds, yeah. Okay.
The Alaska Affordable Energy Strategy found that many communities and utilities are in a position to take on more debt financing for cost-effective projects, that the communities need more flexibility in funding opportunities, and they need to address their needs, and they need assistance in accessing those opportunities. In some circumstances, administrative capacity can be the limiting factor in securing existing financing options. What we need, then, is a way to make it a little bit easier for utilities and communities to access financing. And by financing, I mean both grants and loans. We've already seen the ability of dynamic capital stacks to bring energy projects to fruition. A good recent example is Waterfall Creek Hydroelectric Facility in King Cove, Alaska, which started with Renewable Energy Fund grant money and also utilized Power Project Fund loan money and bonding through the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank, as well as local match to put together the financing package necessary to complete that project. But putting that funding stack together was really complex, and not every community has the know-how or capacity on site to be able to do that. And for those communities especially, access to a one-stop shop for financing could play an important role. We're calling this one-stop shop the Community Energy Fund for Alaska, or CEFA. The CEFA will be a one-stop shop acting as both a funding source and a matchmaker with other financers. The CEFA would be accessible by utilities, municipalities, boroughs, cities, tribes, and non-residential facilities to the extent that is allowable by the original funder. And the CEFA would be available for generation, distribution, transmission, and demand-side efficiency projects. The use of CEFA funds would require that the state make a determination that the project is a cost-effective strategy for meeting the community's energy needs, thereby improving the quality of projects that are developed by the state.
Representative Spahnholz.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Lister, could you please define CEFA again?
Oh, sure. Community Energy Fund for Alaska.
Thank you.
Access to...
And I was going to... I've got a whole bunch of questions. You want me to wait to the end?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, if you would.
Okay.
Thank you. Access to financing assistance is important because it maximizes the leveraging of non-state dollars. It can provide financing flexibility to serve the needs of communities. It reduces transaction costs for both borrowers and lenders, and it will help with the transition from grants to loans, which we're already seeing is beginning. This next recommendation creates a loan offering with refund provisions that rewards project performance. Portions of a loan for energy infrastructure would be refunded if the borrower meets objective standards for performance and reporting that will help maintain the economic life of the infrastructure. Project type, phase, and applicant attributes could be used to determine what percentage of the state loan would be eligible for forgiveness. This loan would be an alternative to straight grant funding, creating a mechanism for stretching state dollars further and providing an incentive for communities to maintain infrastructure for their entire economic life. This next recommendation relates to CPACE and on-bill financing, and I'll, because you have this committee has already heard about CPACE, I'll sort of skip that part and just go to on-bill financing. On-bill financing works in much the same way that commercial PACE does, but repayment of the debt is through the utility bill. Both mechanisms allow for less risk to the lender and more attractive terms to the borrower. These tools can save energy and money and create business opportunity in both the financing industry and the construction trades. They're great for local economies. Within the study area, CPACE would be valuable in mostly in Southeast and hubs and more urban parts of the study area, and on-bill financing could potentially work throughout the study area. Recommendation B5, the first part of this recommendation is to stabilize funding for the low-income weatherization assistance program. Of government programs, government energy programs, residential weatherization generally has the best return on investment for energy savings to consumers. We recommend maintaining a baseline funding of $10 million per year, enabling the continuation of this important program and capitalizing on the trained workforce that has been built up since the program received an increase in state funding in 2008. The second part of the recommendation is to modify the rules of the Home Energy Rebate Program to create a sliding scale income-based match requirement so that should this program receive funding in the future, it is better able to serve rural areas of the state as well as those households whose incomes may exceed the low-income weatherization limit but aren't high enough that they have cash on hand available to participate in the Home Energy Rebate Program as it's currently structured. The six recommendations under the Accountability and Sustainability pillar are focused on creating a system of requirements and incentives that maximize operational life of infrastructure and provides for financial and management standards that will increase ability to access debt financing. This first recommendation is to strengthen business and financial management assistance for PCE-eligible utilities. Reducing the non-fuel cost of power through efficient business operations could save millions of dollars per year for both consumers and the state. In PCE communities, non-fuel costs make up a little under half, and it varies from year to year, depending on the price of fuel primarily, but it currently makes up a little bit less than half of total electric cost. Creating more efficient business and management practices translates into a direct savings to both consumers and to the state through reduced PCE payments. Good business management includes operational practices that ensure equipment is properly maintained and lasts for its expected useful life. And improved financial management will also assist communities to better access financing and be able to secure attractive terms when they do. AEA already does some of this work through the PCE program and through technical assistance, but there is much greater need than can currently be met. Codifying the commitment is what is being recommended. Recommendation C2 builds off of a successful existing regional activity and recognizes that, one, the state cannot and should not do everything, and that, two, regional entities often know community needs better and are more able to quickly respond to those needs. Non-state, regional, and statewide entities such as TAMNOD Chiefs Conference and Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium are just two good examples of organizations that are already doing this type of work. They are creating economies of scale for service provision and providing technical assistance to meet community needs in certain geographic areas and/or disciplines. Some examples of the types of assistance that might be provided by regional and/or non-state entities or appropriate include management of utility finances and accounting, expansion of regional utility cooperatives, fuel purchasing cooperatives, management of building efficiency programs or projects, operations and maintenance of both buildings and generation systems, and electrical emergency response assistance. Under the current system, an entity must meet the standard of being fit, willing, and able in order to be issued a CPCN, and a CPCN is a Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity, which allows them to serve a defined service area. Once a CPCN is issued, a utility does not have to provide evidence at any future point that they are still fit, willing, and able to provide the services that are required under the CPCN. Requiring that PCE-eligible utilities continue to demonstrate their financial, managerial, and technical fitness will help ensure that assets are maintained for their economic life and ensure that financial and managerial health of utilities will minimize non-fuel costs and improve their access to traditional debt financing. We recommend that all community buildings that receive power cost equalization and are greater than 5,000 square feet be required to have an energy audit and implement the recommendations of those audits should they provide net savings within 10 years. Having efficient community facilities allows communities to spread the community facility subsidy allocation over a larger number of buildings, and it lowers community facility operating costs, freeing up funds to perform core services, and helps to ensure that the PCE program is not subsidizing more kilowatt hours than are necessary. Currently, the RCA, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, makes a determination on the eligibility of new energy infrastructure development after it has been built. Research performed for the Affordable Energy Strategy found that this is a barrier to private investment as it is a source of uncertainty. Siting authority could reduce this uncertainty and at the same time add a layer of consumer protection. This next recommendation, C6, is designed to provide a requirement for utilities to do continuous quality improvement, seeking out and implementing cost-effective opportunities to reduce fuel consumption. Having a fuel reduction target allows for a wider range of project or program possibilities than an efficiency or a renewable target, which are also types of targets that we often see in the utility industry. But both of those, if cost-effective, could contribute. The recommendation supports the 2010 state energy policy, a 50% renewable goal, and the 15% improvement in energy efficiency, and the recommendation also supports the Alaska statute pertaining to cost minimization, which requires PCE-eligible utilities to, quote, cooperate with appropriate state agencies to implement cost-effective energy conservation measures and to plan for and implement feasible alternatives to diesel generation. I do want to emphasize that the cost-effective portion of this recommendation is really important. We are not recommending that utilities move forward with any programs or projects that would increase cost to consumers. This last section is the good stuff, the funding, the programs. The statute that created the Affordable Energy Strategy had two distinct requirements for program funding recommendations. The first was to suggest potential revenue sources for funding state energy programs and projects recommended by the study, and the second was to recommend a means of directly underwriting energy costs or subsidizing. The first funding option is to use the Affordable Energy Fund. The same legislation that created this study effort included creation of the Affordable Energy Fund, which would take 20% of revenue from royalties off of a future gas line to pay for energy projects and programs in the study area. At the time of that the legislation was passed, this fund was estimated to at some point generate $80 to $160 million annually. But with completion of the gas line project at least a decade out and the need for continued investment in energy infrastructure today, we need to identify alternative revenue sources for different projects and programs should they be implemented. One potential revenue source for a very small subsection of energy programs and services is the PCE fund. We want to acknowledge the importance of maintaining the endowment in perpetuity and are only suggesting for consideration a small increase in the allocation from earnings to administer the PCE program and directly related critical support services. For many years, the full administrative cost of the PCE program has been subsidized with general fund dollars. Lacking these GF dollars, we recommend using existing statutory authority to fully cover the cost of administering the PCE program. In addition, some programs have a logical, critical connection to the effectiveness and success of PCE. These programs could potentially be paid for with earnings from the endowment. These programs, circuit rider, operator training, and technical assistance, contribute to the energy safety, stability, and reliability, and without which, some small isolated utilities would operate at much higher cost and at higher risk of failure. Recommendation D3, a number of energy policy reports in the past as well have identified a per unit energy surcharge, generally referred to as a systems benefit charge or a universal service charge, depending on what industry you're talking about. These charges, which are common in the lower 48, help create revenue streams to fund cost-effective programs and projects. The proposed universal charge would help to fund electric and heating projects in the study area. It is suggested that the universal service charge from electricity would be allocated for electric utilities, and the charge from heating oil and natural gas would be allocated to bulk fuel and heating-related efficiency projects. AEA was required to come up with a way to directly underwrite the cost of energy in communities without cost-effective infrastructure. We recommend the continuation of the Power Cost Equalization Program and to bring back the Alaska Heating Assistance Program, which was unfunded last year. The Power Cost Equalization Program is the largest and most broad-based consistent source of energy funding in the study area. There are two really significant points related to the PCE program that we want to emphasize. First, opportunities presented in the Affordable Energy Strategy are expected to reduce the cost of energy, but not enough to eliminate the need for the PCE program. Second, it is extremely important to maintain the integrity of the PCE Endowment Fund to ensure the sustainability of the PCE benefit. And finally, one additional idea for consideration. a state entity with the authority to consolidate and manage consumer energy to the extent that is reasonable would increase efficiency of delivering state energy programs to communities. This is not a new idea, but one that perhaps merits renewed consideration. Consumer energy is such an important issue in Alaska that it is imperative that efforts to address these challenges be coordinated at a high level to be both efficient and effective. Implementation of the previous recommendations may spread state energy programs over half a dozen agencies. This would be further complicated by institutional gaps and competing agency mandates. Developing a coordinated and strategic plan to best assist communities may become problematic without consolidated authority. The state entity would coordinate all aspects of these recommendations, with the exception, of course, of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, which has to remain independent. In conclusion, keeping the lights on and buildings heated requires investing in energy infrastructure and ensuring that those investments are protected over the long term. Despite the state's current budgetary challenges, we, the state, can take action to ensure to encourage stronger and more affordable community energy systems through policy, regulatory, and statutory change. The Affordable Energy Strategy provides guidance for that change.
Thank you for your presentation. I'm sure we have some questions, and Representative Johnson, you may begin. Mm-hmm.
So, in your recommendation of A3, you are suggesting, or are you suggesting, a statewide building code other than what's already on the books?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, all of the recommendations in this study only apply to the study area. So, not statewide. The statute required that we just make recommendations for the study area.
And so that study area do you see that merging with what already is there for Alaska housing and federal housing programs, or do you see it above and beyond what they already have in place as far as loan programs and federal grant programs for building in the rural areas? Since they are generally the funders of a lot of the building, have you looked at that?
Do you want to take it?
Sure. Through the chair, this is Katie Conway, Representative Johnson. I'm not sure I completely understand, so let me take a shot at it. We are referring to a building energy code here, and building off of the research that's been done, a lot of that by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and others, the Governor's Housing Summit last year recommended a building energy code, and that was maybe one of the most recent on a long list of events or documents discussing building energy code. So maybe I don't understand.
Well, I'm just saying that the financing requires certain building standards, and I mean you have service areas in many different municipalities that have building codes, and then you have areas outside those service areas that don't have building codes. But if they want to get financing from certain entities, banks, or if this is a federally funded housing program. And I just wondered if you looked at that when you were discussing this.
This is Katie Lister, through the chair, Representative Johnston. I think that I understand your point. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation has the Building Energy Efficiency Standard, or BEES. And so if you, for example, have a mortgage that is underwritten by HFC, then your building has to meet BEES standards. And so in the absence of a building energy code, HFC has actually been quite effective in creating a more efficient housing stock through those requirements and through their really active role in the mortgage market in Alaska. And additionally, housing funds that come through the Native American Housing and Self-Determination Act to regional housing authorities that do a lot of the building in rural communities sometimes come with specific building code requirements and energy requirements. So, but it is still almost always the number one recommendation of policy reports that we have seen in Alaska over the last 20 years. It is a best practice nationwide to have a building energy code so that you are not missing, you're not creating gaps in that system.
And I understand, for the chair, sorry, a follow-up. I understand that. I also have concerns sometimes because when we codify, well, when we have codes, sometimes our codes become antiquated very quickly. And actually, science and technology tends to do this, and our codes tend to do that. And so I would want to be cautious on how that's approached, because it could be just as detrimental as it could be helpful. Follow up?
Representative Johnson.
I was leaving everything to the end. Let me understand, as far as your one-stop shop, your financing, I think it was B2, and I talked just long enough that I lost my page. I'm a little confused on this. Is this a source of information and a source of coordination, or is it an administrative, or is this a source for all funds to go through?
Through the chair, this is Kate Lister. Representative Johnston, it's all of those things. It's sort of as it has been conceptualized. There are a lot of weeds and a lot of nitty-gritty that would need to be kind of jumped into to actually establish something like this. But the barrier that it is addressing is one that we see with some frequency, and that is small communities that lack administrative capacity to be able to jump through the sometimes really substantial hurdles related to federal funding opportunities, both grants and loans, figuring out how to access appropriate financing, and even just sort of understand the landscape. So we envision it as a place where those communities could come. We would let, if it were housed at AEA, we have a loan offering that would be part of it, but we imagine being able to connect them to other and assist with putting together a financing package. So it would be information. We also can anticipate being able to accept certain types of funds. For example, there is federal funding that could flow through an entity like this and be made available with a little bit less sort of paperwork on the part of the borrower, just to sort of ease that access to financing.
And do you see, if it was AEA, a negotiation between you and other state entities who are doing other aspects? I mean, you do have conflict. Yeah, to me it looks like it's a real big push-pull, just Alaska Housing and AEA, and it's on first, or it could be, and with other forms of funding, state funding. I mean, if you're coordinating all of them in an educational and administrative way, that would be one thing. But as I say, there's a lot of silos there, and there's also a lot of, I could see where you might get into a push-pull situation.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I think that it is really a connecting and a coordinating. I mean, okay. And some of that with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, since you mentioned them in particular, I mean, we already do a lot of that, a lot of coordinating with them and helping work with communities to understand what is being offered and who specifically has the sort of the details on the program or loan program that they're interested in, to connect them more quickly and easily. So an enhancement of that work.
Okay, and a follow-up. When you were talking about different groups that you've done your outreach to, have you also gone to Alaska Municipal League?
Through the chair, this is Katie Conway, Representative Johnston. We are presenting at AML in a week or two, and one of their staff has participated in some events where we have presented the Affordable Energy Strategy. I don't know if we've done... I'm going to have to defer to Neil McMahon. Neil, are you on the line?
Hi, this is Neil McMahon from the Lawrence Energy Authority. To respond to that question, no, I did not reach out specifically to AML.
It would just be a suggestion because those are the folks that actually would be coming to you for this, a lot of this, and I would, you know, in your effort to keep it simple, it might be a great resource. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I might have a couple. The state funding for weatherization, is that a grant money or is that loan money?
Through the chair, that's grant money.
Okay. And as far as the cost using the PCE fund is administered with, I just assumed that came out of the PCE, much like the permanent fund, but I guess this would change that. I think the permanent fund is self-funding, but PCE is not self-funding. Basically, you're getting extra funding to fund the fund. Management, obviously.
I will start that and then probably ask Katie to fill in any gaps. This is Katie Conway. We do get some funding to cover a part of the administrative cost. This would be fully covering the administrative cost. I think the rough estimate is approximately $600,000 a year. But I would have to follow up with you if you wanted to know the actual breakdown. I have that in email. I can probably get it to you this afternoon.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. The universal service charge, would that be applied to non-rail belt utilities for use in non-rail belt areas? Is that correct?
Through the chair, this is Katie Lister. That's correct. It is every recommendation in the study is about non-rail belt utilities in the non-rail belt study area. There are the way that universal service charges are implemented is varies. Generally within the electric industry, if a charge that is collected within that service area stays within that service area in the United States. In Europe and Canada, there's a lot of cross-subsidization between, in Canada, for example, they have a lot of mature legacy hydro projects that have very low energy costs, and those rate payers pay a charge that goes to lower the cost of energy in isolated diesel-reliant communities. So there is variability in how that is applied.
I guess I've just heard comments that in most utilities in the non-rail belt area, certainly not all of them, but are very isolated, that only deal with a specific community or a couple. I know that AVEC has 48 communities. But if you're looking at, what was your mean, 62 cents a kilowatt hour, and you're talking about adding a charge on top of that, that seems... it might be tough for some of these communities to pay more, and that money would then stay in that distinct community, or that's to be determined, I guess.
Through the chair, I believe that would have to be determined through a public and deliberative process.
Okay. And let's see. The state entity, that would be different than AEA, although AEA is a bit of a state entity that manages a lot of projects and funding and so forth. How would the state entity that you mentioned be different, or will it be different than what you're doing right now?
Through the chair, this is Katie Lister, and the recommendation is to create a state entity with authority for consumer energy programs
just to sort of make that clear, we're not necessarily recommending that AEA be that state entity. AEA programs do cover a very wide range of energy programs, and Alaska Housing Finance Corporation is focused on more the demand side and housing. You know, they focus on that side of the energy equation. Department of Transportation and Public Facilities does a lot of energy retrofits on public buildings. I mean, there are a lot of different agencies making decisions about consumer energy, and the recommendation is to bring that together so that there's one authority who could kind of create a strategic plan and just be more effective in the implementation. Probably also a little bit more efficient, because of coordination, but more importantly, just to be more effective. And there, if you're looking for kind of like specific ways in which operations would be different, I may have to defer to Neil or get back to you. There are a number of kind of different approaches that have been recommended in the past, from the Department of Energy to Isaacson. Sort of in the last couple of years had a big recommendation for a virtual Department of Energy. So those are some of the.
No, it's just interesting that I know there's a lot of different groups doing similar things, and I'm sure there's some efficiency in bringing it together and not having duplication and maybe coordination of data and coordination of project knowledge and stuff like that. So mm-hmm. Just curious. Representative Smallholz.
Thank you. Through the chair, you know, there are quite a few recommendations in your in the energy strategy, the affordable energy strategy, that predict, you know, or would are expected to produce cost savings. Do you have modeling on any of those, or is it too soon at this point, or is there, I presume, like a big thick document that backs this up that would have some of the models and charts that we could look at that help us sort of understand where the bigger drivers are?
Through the chair, this is Katie Lister, Representative Sponholz. Yes, we do have all of those things, and we'd be happy to provide them to you. The sort of 250 plus page document is in final editing right now and should be up on our website soon. We will definitely get it, make sure that everybody is aware of that. The affordable energy model is an interactive tool that you can access through our website right now, and has good documentation about all of the data that is driving it. If you're interested, and of course we're available to answer any questions about that, you know, should you decide to take a deeper dive and have follow-up questions.
Thank you. You did mention the affordable energy model earlier today, and I didn't remember that, and I think that my team and I will definitely be taking a deeper dive, maybe some very intriguing bedtime reading. Thank you.
Is there any further comments or questions? Seeing none, I'd like to thank you both for your presentation today, and I'm sure we'll be hearing from you again in the future on other energy-related issues. At that, I will adjourn this meeting. Our next meeting, we will not have a meeting on Thursday, but we'll have one next week, and stay tuned for more details on that. And at 12 p.m. this morning.